Hello, I'm Chris Situla, and welcome to the latest installment of That's History, a regular segment where we discuss events from the past and the echoes and parallels and resonance they have for us today. Joining me, as always, is Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here, as always.
Okay, I'm going to give you two dots, and I want you to explain them and connect them. The first dot is Title IX, and the second is Temple University sports. But let's start with Title IX. What is Title IX?
Title IX was an amendment to one of the Federal Education Acts, which passed in 1972 and was signed by Richard Nixon. And on its face, it's quite simple. It says that if you, as an educational institution, receive federal dollars, you can't discriminate on the basis of sex or gender. What's fascinating about it, when it passed, is as best we can tell, nobody was thinking about sports.
Really?
Yeah. One of its sponsors was Patsy Mink, who was a well-known representative from Hawaii. And she was interviewed about it subsequently, and she said, you know, for me, it was about the fact that I had wanted to be a physician, a medical doctor, and I couldn't. This would have been in the late 50s or early 60s because very few women did, because medical schools discriminated against them. So she wasn't thinking about sports, and as best we can tell, nobody else was.
But very soon, people were thinking about Title IX in sports because only a few years later, it was seen as a threat to major college football, to the Big Ten, to the Southeastern Athletic Conference and all of that.
I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the inequalities between men and women in sports were just especially egregious, and you could count them. For example, I found out that the Syracuse, New York School District spent $90,000 pre-Title IX on boys' sports and $200 on girls' sports. And then one year they had to cut the budget to $87,000 for the boys, so they just got rid of the $200 for girls. So it was extremely egregious, and again, you could count it. And also, sports have a symbolic role in our society, and I think that they're a venue for a certain sort of competition that we want to be equal, ergo the phrase level playing field.
Right.
I don't think it's a coincidence that the best-known African-American of the 20th century is Martin Luther King Jr., and the second best-known is Jackie Robinson, a baseball player, because sports have a huge symbolic role in the way that we construct equality.
And it would be, I'm sure, arguable that the others on that list would include names like Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, and Tiger Woods.
Absolutely.
Right.
Right. Again, how does football get involved? What happens very quickly is Title IX does become about sports. Title IX, incidentally, did not say that you have to have the same number of male and female athletes. In fact, athletic directors were very worried about that. They called it the 50-50 option. But back in 72, the majority of college students were male. And so what they got, which is what they wanted, was this rule saying you have to work towards proportionality, which means that the fraction of your athletes has to be roughly proportional to the representation of men, women, and the overall student population. What they didn't know is that women were about to outpace men in college writ large, and 30 years later, there would be, well, 56-57% female.
Right. Those whom the gods would punish, they give them what they want.
Precisely.
Right?
That's right. So it was really the athletic director's worst nightmare. So what are we going to do? And to go back to football, there's this worry, really from the beginning, that we'll have to raid the football treasury, all the millions that are generated by football, in order to fund new women's teams.
Right. So, and this will, in very short order, get us to what recently happened to the intercollegiate sports programs at Temple. But what actually evolves in response to Title IX is essentially a two-tiered system where football and arguably basketball, men's basketball, are over on one track, and everything else done athletically at a college is on another track.
That's precisely right. And again, you can look it up. I mean, we think that in the Division I level, 80% of the athletic budget goes to two teams. It goes to football, which is all men, and to men's basketball. And so really the response to Title IX has been to try to protect football and to a lesser degree men's basketball, and then try to equalize everything else. And inevitably what that has meant, and it meant this at Temple, is cutting some men's teams. So we see in the 80s especially, we see men's wrestling getting cut because this is a way to try to bring more gender balance without cutting into anything that football or basketball does.
Right, but it also means adding a certain number of women's sports that get great participation, but cost far less than the big ticket sports.
Exactly. Including rowing, and that's one of the ironies of Temple cutting women's rowing as part of this cost-saving plan, is that rowing really picked up after Title IX because it was a way that you could enlist a lot of female athletes because the teams are big, and they don't necessarily have to be people that are expert at it or even did it in high school. So you see a tremendous burst of women's rowing post-Title IX.
Mm-hmm. Let's just stop for a moment and review what actually happened at Temple. What happened at Temple?
What happened at Temple is that they cut 7 varsity sports, 5 male sports, and 2 female ones, again, rowing and softball. And the justifications were interesting because part of it, they did invoke Title IX, and they said they still weren't in compliance. Almost nobody is. And they wanted to improve their balance, between men and women. But the most important thing was cost. You know, they said these teams cost a total of $3 million. The athletic department had already lost a bunch of revenue, and this would be a way to save money.
Right. So one of the ironies here with this happening at Temple, which has been much discussed, is the Temple men's football team is not exactly one of the juggernauts of the sport. They've been more like a homeless waif wandering from conference to conference looking for somebody to take them in. They play to mostly empty houses at Lincoln Financial Field. So it's particularly curious at Temple, but let me push back a little bit against what you're saying. When we're talking, you know, Michigan, Ohio State, Nebraska, Alabama, Georgia, these incredibly successful programs are huge moneymakers for the universities, aren't they? Aren't they sort of, you know, the golden calf who you wouldn't get rid of?
Actually not. I mean, some of the programs that you just mentioned are. But when people add it up, it seems that actually most big-time football programs lose money. Do they bring in lots of revenue with respect to, you know, the gate, that is tickets at the gate, and sometimes TV contracts, et cetera? They absolutely do. But they're also enormously costly between travel and health and equipment. And all of the coaching. I mean, remember, we think that at the big-time programs, the average college football coach makes $2 million. That's the average. So do they bring in lots of money? Absolutely they do, but they spend a ton, and a lot of them spend more than they bring in.
Right. One statistic that really jumped out at me in the essay you wrote about this topic on newsworks.org is, I don't remember which big-time football program it was, but spends $175,000 each year on what?
On hotels during home games. This actually was Rutgers, our neighbor in New Jersey, which also cut 6 or 7 sports teams a few years ago, one of which was male tennis. And somebody did the numbers and figured out that actually the budget for male tennis was almost exactly the same as the budget for the football team's hotels at home games, which left some of us shaking our heads and wondering why you need hotels for home games. But I guess that'll be for another show.
Right. Well, you know, the tennis team's loss is the Marriott Corporation's gain.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's an ill wind that blows no good.
Exactly.
So we know that some of the victims of Title IX have tended to be, call them, for the sake of argument, the more minor men's sports, even sometimes some of the women's sports. But the overall picture on Title IX is not just one of devastation and inequality and disaster.
Oh, certainly not. I mean, if you're a woman and you play a high school or college sport, or if you have a daughter or a granddaughter who does, you should thank Title IX, and here's why. We think in 1972, at the high school level, 7% of varsity athletes were female, and 30 years later, over 40% of them are. And at colleges, the skew, or the improvement, if you will, is similar. So is it equal? Well, it isn't. And again, one of the myths about the law is it's supposed to make everything equal. It isn't. What it's supposed to do is promote women's participation. And I think in 50 or 100 years' time, it will be regarded as one of the great success stories in the history of federal legislation. It's really hard to put a price, to put a value, when you think about it, of what all of us have gained from Title IX in the sense of the different images and the different roles that we can now imagine women playing, literally and figuratively, that we couldn't before Title IX.
I will say that as you were talking, what was hitting home to me was the memory last year, WHYY broadcast one of the University of Delaware women's basketball team's games from the Bob, the Carpenter Center, down in Newark, because the number one college player in the land played at the University of Delaware, Elena Delladonna.
Yeah.
And the arena is full, absolutely full of people cheering for that group of women athletes. And, I mean, it had the atmosphere of an Eagles game, and it was extraordinary.
And it's interesting you mention that, because there is one other critique of Title IX, which is that it's almost been too successful and that it's brought to women some of the negative aspects of male college sports. So certain kids have been admitted who probably shouldn't have based on their academic record. And also there's been a little too much pressure on female athletes as it becomes more competitive. So you see, you know, repetitive strain injuries and eating disorders and things of that nature that are in some ways a function of it becoming too competitive, too much like, well, men.
Right. Talking to Jonathan Zimmer of New York University, and I would hasten to add that we were talking about unqualified athletes. We weren't talking about any members of the University of Delaware women's basketball team, for all you Blue Hens fans out there.
Understood.
So, Jonathan, looking forward, since Temple is certainly not the only university around the land where this kind of thing is happening, do you see any prospect of change in the law? I mean, how much energy is there around this topic?
Well, you know, I think that it's fair to say that the law, again, has been a huge success in terms of increasing female participation and interest, which are two goals of the law. But you might say that it's maxed out what it can do given the fiscal realities. The fiscal realities are that the universities are devoting really an ever greater fraction of their athletic dollar to mainly football and secondarily basketball. And until that changes, it seems to me there's only so much Title IX can do. What we've created is a situation in which we pit the have-nots against the have-nots. That is, we pit the small male sports against the female sports. And they're both have-nots in the sense that they receive, and you could say also generate, very little revenue. And it seems to me that we've kind of maxed out in what we can do in that zone. And until we have a really serious conversation about the amount of revenue we're devoting to football, there's only so much equality we're going to get.
So we've been talking about Title IX and college sports with Jonathan Zimmerman of New York University. Thank you, Jonathan, as always.
Thanks. It was fun.
And that's another episode of That's History. Thank you for listening.